Hello and welcome to Through the Bible with Les Feldick, an inspirational and informative half hour of insight into the heart of Scripture. In addition to teaching the Bible, Les is a full-time rancher, having a down-to-earth practical teaching style that makes the Bible come to life. All programs are available on audio tape, videotape, and in printed form. At the end of the program, there will be an address where you can contact the ministry. And now, here's Les Feldick with today's lesson.
Ken, back to Philippians then. Chapter 2, where we left off at the end of our last program, in verse 6, he thought it not robbery or something to grasp to be equal with God, because he was God. He could rightfully claim to be God. All right, verse 7, but as the eternal, holy, righteous, omniscient, omnipotent, sovereign God, he made of himself, of his own volition, a servant. Now, you want to remember the word servant in our English, in the Greek, was a bondslave. Literally, a bondslave. Now, of course, there were various categories of slaves, but I think the epitome of slavery, at least back in the ancients, was to be that poor fellow on the bottom part of the boat or the ship pulling the oars. I mean, those were slaves. And they sat down in the holds of those ships and pulled those oars until their hands were like hamburger. And when they died, they pitched them overboard and put another one in his place. That was a bond slave. And, of course, they had other categories. But this is the one I usually think of. When I think of a bond slave, I think of that poor, poor benighted soul that was delegated to that kind of a life until he died. And you want to remember, that was most of the ancient world. Very few enjoyed the comforts of life. That was just a small percentage of the wealthy and in the aristocracy, which, of course, precipitated the likes of the French Revolution. This is exactly what precipitated. Not that it was right, but the masses have been held down and have been caused so much suffering for so long that finally it just, like a seething pot, it just boils over. But whatever. Christ made of his own volition himself a bondslave at the very lowest of human categories, made in the likeness of men. Now, come back with me to Genesis chapter 18, which I usually teach as an event in the Old Testament account to show us so graphically how God would come down and appear to the patriarchs in human form. But, of course, back here in the Old Testament, it was temporary. Genesis 18. Here in the Old Testament, it was temporary. And as soon as he had accomplished that particular purpose for coming down and appearing to, in this case, Abraham, he would just simply disappear and go back into glory, into the Godhead. But he still appeared to these people in human form, which was all just a precursor of when he would finally come in the flesh, not to just be a poof and out of their sight, but to be confined to that body then of flesh and bone for, I feel, all eternity. All right, but here in chapter 18 of Genesis, it's been a long time since we've taught it, on television at least. And so verse 1, the Lord, that's Jehovah, that's God the Son in the Old Testament terminology. And so Jehovah appeared unto him, Abram, in the plains of Mamre, as he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day. And he lifted up his eyes and looked, and lo, three what? Men. Now men have always looked like men. There wasn't a time when they had funny looking ears and bulbous eyes and all that. Men have always looked like men. And these men did not have wings. They did not have glowing halos around their head. They were three ordinary wayfaring men from outward appearances, see? All right, but you move on down and you'll see where Abram runs and he says, let a little water, I pray you, verse 4, be fetched and wash your feet, see? Ordinary human feet. Rest yourselves under the tree. And then you come on down to verse 8. I'm doing this just for sake of time. He took butter and milk and the calf which he had dressed, set it before them, these three men. And he stood by them under the tree, and all three of them, what? They ate. They ate. But now, who are these three people? Well, one is the Lord himself, and the other two are angels. But you see what happens? They came down in human form, came walking up the path, or whatever the case may be, to Abram's tent, and Abram recognized them as wayfaring strangers, of course, and showed his Middle Eastern hospitality, fixed a meal for them, and filled their water bottles or whatever, and then he says, you can be on your way. Little did he know, of course, that one of them would be Jehovah God himself. Now, the same way with Jacob. Jacob wrestled with a man. Not some enigma, not some figment of his imagination, as the scoffers would say. Jacob wrestled with a flesh-type human being. But it was the Lord in a temporary appearance, and then he went up from him. All right, but now you see, when he comes by way of the virgin birth, he is the same God, but instead of just all of a sudden making a poof and disappear from their sight, he comes all the way through the birth of a woman. He comes through his childhood. He comes into manhood. And he begins his ministry at the age of 30. And begins then to show by his signs and wonders and miracles his deity, who he really was. But every time somebody looked at him or had a meal with him, he didn't just suddenly disappear. He was there. And they could touch him. They could shake hands with him. They could eat with him. But yet, as he was on the roaring waves of Galilee, he could step out into the open, raise his hand, and simply say, peace be still. And what happened? The wind died down and the waves slowed up, and the disciples were just amazed. And what did they say? What kind of a man is this, that even the wind obeys his voice? Well, I'll tell you what kind of a man he was. He was God. He never, never stopped being God. In the womb of Mary, he was still God. As he was the little child playing on the streets of Nazareth in the carpenter shop, he was God. And as he confounded the doctors at the age of 12 there at the temple, he was God. See? And never lose sight of that. All right, so now as you come back into our text here in Philippians chapter 2, even though he had made himself in the likeness of men, he didn't look one bit different than another average man in Nazareth. He didn't look any different than the average Jew during his 3 years of earthly ministry. They couldn't look at him and say, oh, that's the God man. No, they couldn't do that. He looked just as normal as anybody else. But when the particular situation demanded it, he could show his deity, that he was God in the flesh. All right, now the next verse, verse 8. And being found in fashion as a man, from all outward appearances, from all his daily activity, he was just a man. And not only an upper echelon man, a lower echelon man. Now, you want to remember, Joseph and Mary in Nazareth were probably next to poverty. I was just reading an account again the other day of a family in Israel, and where the father was a wood craftsman, just barely eking out an existence. Well, I'm sure it's always been that way. So he did not live in a family and a home of wealth. It was abject poverty. He lived as a bondslave, a servant. That was his level amongst humanity. All right, so being found in fashion, again, verse 8, as a man, he humbled himself. No one else did it. In other words, the governmental authorities of Rome didn't humble him. The priesthood in Jerusalem didn't humble him. Even God's, as we think of God in his heaven, didn't humble him. He humbled himself. It was of his own free will. of his own volition, he brought it all to pass. Now, another verse comes to mind, and I didn't intend to use this one. I really didn't. But Acts, and we have used it before, Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 2, dropping down to verse 22 and 23. Acts 2, verses 22 and 23. You'll recognize it as soon as you see it. Y'all there? And Peter is preaching the day of Pentecost. And he says, "Ye men of Israel, hear these words, Jesus of Nazareth," the one I've just been talking about, the carpenter's son, "a man," see, Peter doesn't call him the God man, "a man, approved of God among you by miracles and wonders and signs, which God," in his whole triune being, of course, "which God did by him in the midst of you," that is up and down the towns and villages of Israel, "as you yourselves also know," because most of them had seen at least some of those miracles. But now verse 23, "him," Jesus of Nazareth, "being delivered," that is up to the cross, "by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God." Now, what does that determinate counsel mean? God had programmed it. God had drawn the blueprint that when man would sin, he would provide a redeemer. And that redeemer would have to go to a Roman cross. All right, and so it was all in the foreknowledge of God that Israel has taken and by wicked hands have crucified and slain. All right, all in the foreknowledge of God. Now, coming back to Philippians then, so when Christ sent his eyes as flint toward the cross, it was of his own volition, although the whole Godhead is certainly involved in the operation of it all. Verse 8 again, I'm going to spend the rest of this half hour at least, and maybe the next one, I don't know. But this verse 8 is something else. "And so he was found in fashion as a man from all outward appearances. He humbled himself and became," because again of his own volition, "he became obedient unto death," not just an ordinary death, not just a death by execution of the normal way, but even the death of the cross. Now, this is what I want people out in television, I want everyone to realize. It wasn't just the crucifixion by him by itself that made this so unique. Thousands of people were put to death by crucifixion under the Roman emperors. Nero at one time had 2,000 crucified and placed on each side of one of the Roman roads, so that he could ride up and down between them with his chariot and gloat at their suffering. So you see, the crucifixion alone was not what made our faith in the gospel unique. But I'll tell you what made it different from everything else. And if I don't teach anything else today that will sink in the minds of people, this is what I want it to be. That when Christ died on that Roman cross, every sin of the whole human race, from Adam until the last person before we go to eternity, was laid on him. Now imagine all the horrible sin and guilt of a Hitler was laid on Christ. Every sin and thought and deed of a man like Nero was laid on him. And every wicked person that you can ever conjure up in your mind, every sin was laid on him on that cross. That's what we mean by the death of the cross. Now you see, nothing, no one short of the power and the might and the holiness of an omnipotent Creator God could have even thought of doing such a thing. And I said in my first program, I laid awake part of the night last night mulling this over. Listen, there is not another religion, if you want to call it that, on the face of this earth that can claim to have someone within their belief system that could claim to have all the sins of the world placed upon them. Muhammad couldn't do it. He was human. Regardless of what the Muslims may think, he was still human. The head of the Buddhist religion couldn't do it. The head of Hinduism couldn't do it. The head man of Shintoism couldn't do it. Joseph Smith couldn't do it. Or any of these other cult leaders. There has never been another individual that could have ever come close to taking every sin of every human being and have it put on him. Now, this is what we have to understand. Now, look at a verse in 2 Corinthians. And maybe this will just sort of explode in your mind. I hope it will. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21. A verse I'm sure you all know, but do we really contemplate the impact of a verse like this? What does it really say? 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21. Oh, got it? God, up in verse 20, is the point of reference. For He, the God of verse 20, He hath made Him, that is Christ, to be sin for us. In other words, He took my sin when He was on the cross. He took your sin. He took the sin of every human being, even the most wicked, the most ungodly. His sin was placed on Christ. All right? And so He became sin for us. He who knew no sin, of course not. He was God. He was sinless. And all for the purpose that we, as believers now, might be made the righteousness of God in Him. All right, another verse. Come all the way back to Isaiah. Haven't used it for a long, long time. And I know when I did use it, I had several letters that were kind of shook up. They never knew that this was in their Bible. Isaiah 52. Isaiah 52. Verse 13 and 14. Isaiah 52. Verses 13 and 14. Behold, my servant. See? There's that bond slave. Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted in spite of his role as a servant. He shall be exalted and extolled and very high. And we're going to see this a little further on in Philippians. But now look at verse 14. You'd be surprised how many people don't know this in their Bible. As many were astonished at thee, his visage, his outward appearance, was so marred or disfigured more than any man. And his form, his whole bodily appearance was so disfigured, it was so marred, it was so utterly distorted than anyone who had ever experienced in human history. Now, you know what that tells me? No wonder Mary couldn't figure out that it was Jesus. Because again, put yourself in her shoes. This is what she saw hanging on the cross as they left to go home. This is what they had as a mental picture of the Christ hanging on the cross before Joseph of Arimathea put him in the tomb. And then to suddenly wake up and in the dim early light see someone standing there who looked very normal. Do you see what I'm driving at? This is why she couldn't comprehend that it was him. Because now, of course, he had now come back in his resurrected body, looking very normal. That's why she thought he was the gardener. But listen, the sins of this world were all placed on him. And that's what makes this verse in Philippians so outstanding, that he was obedient to death. Not just a death of taking away his life, not just a death even by an ordinary crucifixion, because thousands had done that. But when it says the death of the cross, this is what I feel the Scripture is trying to tell us. That his death was so horrendous, and that no one but the sovereign, eternal Creator God could have attempted to do such a thing, but he could. See, and that's what makes Christianity all by itself. This is where no other religion in the world can even come close, because they have no one that could make the claim that he has taken all their sin and put it on himself. And so, here again, this is where you and I have to stand up and let it be known. All the religions of the world are just so much fluff because they can't make this kind of a claim. They can't deal with men's sin. All they can hope to do is elevate him morally, that maybe by his works he can make it. And we know that God will never buy into that. You know, I was so thrilled after our seminar up in Minneapolis the other day. And a gentleman came up, a very distinguished-looking gentleman, and he said, "I'm a retired pastor, and I won't mention the denomination. It was totally different than mine, but that's beside the point." And he came up and he says, "You know, Les," he said, "I am so thrilled that you proclaim the same exclusivist gospel that I do." And he says, "It is exclusivist." Well, I've used the word several years back. Yes, our gospel is exclusivist. It excludes everything else, and it stands head and shoulders by itself. See? And that's what we're going to see a little later on in this chapter, that the name of Christ stands above every name. And then we have people dare to claim that they have another way of access to God. How ridiculous can they get when they have no sin bearer such as we have? See, and this is what you have to have. You have to have a sin bearer. We can't take our sin into glory. We can't take our sin into eternity. It has to have been dealt with. And it was. And we appropriate it how? By believing it. By just simply believing it. Adolf Hitler could have believed that his sin was paid for, realizing that Christ had done it and raised from the dead, and old Adolf Hitler could have gone into glory. Horrible individual that he was. His sins were already paid for. They were already laid on Christ. But you see, he no doubt rejected it in unbelief. And you can think of any other horrible individual. And that's exactly what Paul means. In fact, turn back with me. I hope we got a minute or so. Come back with me to Romans chapter 3. Says it better than I could. Romans. No, I might have to go to 6. Yeah, Romans chapter 5. I'm sorry. Romans 5. Oh boy, got 30 seconds. Turn over fast. You got it, honey? Romans 5, verse 20. "Moreover, the law entered that the offense or sin might abound. But where sin abounded, grace did much more," what? "Abound." So no matter how heinous the sinner, no matter how heavy his sin load, it's all been laid on Christ because he was obedient unto death. But not just a death by crucifixion, a death that suffered the sin of the whole world.
Thank you for joining us again for Through the Bible with Les Feldick. If you'd like to order audio tapes, videos, or any of our printed material, you may do so by writing Les Feldick Ministries, Route 1, Box 760, Kenta, Oklahoma, 74552. That's Les Feldick Ministries, Route 1, Box 760, Kenta, Oklahoma, 74552. Or you can call us toll-free if you'd like at 1-800-369-7856. That's 1-800-369-7856. Remember, this is a faith ministry, and your participation with us is greatly appreciated. Again, our address is Les Feldick Ministries, Route 1, Box 760, Kenta, Oklahoma, 74552. And our phone is 1-800-369-7856. Thanks again for listening, and please join us next time for Through the Bible with Les Feldick.